This is KHBR, the voice of darkness for the intrepid travelers of the left-hand path. I'm Magister Robert Adams, your host. We'll be accompanying you on your journey. So get ready, sit back, relax, and prepare to kefir and remanifest. Welcome to KHPR, the voice of darkness, the show that takes an in-depth look at the left-hand path. I'm Magister Robert Adams, your host, and today we'll be taking a look at music from a left-hand path perspective. With me today is Priest Andrew Keller and Priest James Elliott. Welcome.
Welcome. Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, for people within the Temple of Set, music is very important because we use it to sort of set the stage for workings, and it's very useful in setting the space. And the two of you in particular came up with the Black Muse element that works with music. So why don't, whichever one of you wants to start off first, tell us a little bit about what the Black Muse element is and why it was created in the first place.
Okay. There was a gap in the temple where we had lots and lots of wonderful music being created, but there was no central focus for it. So the idea was to bring it and give it a stronger channel rather than just individuals bringing in their music ad hoc and saying, here is my music, have a listen to it. We would give it an official channel, plus the whole idea of studying music in relation to magic is the sort of main backbone of the Black Muse element.
And just so we keep everyone straight, that was Priest Elliott speaking there, and he's actually with us from Ireland at the moment. The sponsor of the element is Priest Keller. Within the temple, we focus on the Black Flame quite a bit as the central sort of inspirational spark for us. Now, how would you relate the Black Muse to the Black Flame?
Well, I think the relation is pretty direct, at least in the way that I conceived it when James approached me with the idea of sponsoring this element. The creative act is, in and of itself, a recreation of what we call the gift of Set within the temple, the gift of self-awareness and self-directed consciousness. By creating any form of art, whether it be music, visual art, film, etc., we're basically exercising that faculty that is uniquely human, that we can turn it into something that allows us to become even more than human. We bring things into being that otherwise have no existence or meaning, and we give them meaning, and we create a space for their existence. So to me, this was a very natural pairing of magical technology that I've used on my own for many years, even prior to joining the temple, and to give it a unique voice within the temple. As Priest Elliott said, there had been a lot of going on at an individual level within the temple, people creating music that had, some of which had Setian themes, some of which generally would be darker, but not necessarily Setian. The intention was that we would start approaching what would make a uniquely Setian music, which relates very strongly to the music that the Black Muse has created as a group, which Priest Elliott will be talking about a little bit later.
Okay. Now, this is one of the things to me, when I was first reading about how you created the music, it was something that seemed totally alien, yet it was amazingly ingenious. So could you tell our listeners how the music of the Black Muse is created?
The music of Black Muse originated from, again, trying to get this central focus, trying to give a central channel for members of the temple who were musicians but lived in various parts of the world. And we have this wonderful technology now, the internet, etc., etc., and we can now create music together. So I originally set it up as a trial to see if it could be done, and I thought we need to give certain parameters because we could just can't ask for people to submit music in various whatever keys they like, etc., etc., and time signatures. So we gave them a basic set of guidelines and a theme, which was just the title of the piece. and it was a pure experiment to see how it would work. But in theory, it should work, because if everyone is working to the same time signature, the same key, and the same tempo, in theory, they should all fit together. And the wonderful thing about it is we have no idea how it's going to sound, because the people who are participating in each piece are totally unaware of who else is participating. Well, they have a rough idea, but they're not exactly sure of who is participating and what they will be participating, so what they will actually be submitting. So I could be getting drum parts, I could be getting vocal parts, guitar parts, whatever, and they all come to me and I have to make sense of the madness, which is immense fun.
In a way, you have to bring order out of the chaos.
Absolutely. And again, it is total chaos. In their original forms, they're quite hilarious, because I get all sorts of little music samples sent to me, and I've got to somehow put this together. But again, that's the fun of it. The whole idea, it's quite reminiscent of an old game that surrealist writers used to play back in the early part of the 1900s, called Exquisite Corpse. And what they would do is one member would write a paragraph. He would fold over the sheet of paper just to reveal, leaving open the last line of his paragraph, and give it to the next person, who would have to then continue on from his last line. And he would write a paragraph and would pass right the right round the room, and the person at the end would read this madness out. And of course, it would end up with surreal Monty Python-esque writing, but however, very, very interesting. So the music of Black Muse is quite similar to that. But because we have set parameters like key signatures, etc., it does tend to come together in some beautiful shape.
Yeah, and one of the things I remember seeing online that really surprised me was it was a piece you were doing for the OV, which is the Order of the Vampire. And yeah. You said the key is C minor, 120 beats per minute, and a 3/4 time signature. And, you know, I was just kind of amazed thinking about that, because, you know, from what I know about music, you know, within C minor, you could do a 1/4/5 chord progression, a 2/7/1 chord progression. And I'm like thinking, what if someone does one chord progression and, you know, someone else is doing another chord progression? How are you going to make that all work together? And in the end, what came out of that was really amazing. And I think actually at the end of the show, I think we should finish the show with that piece.
That would be very nice. Priest Keller is actually leading the next one, which we're writing for the Conclave, for our next gathering. And it should be an exciting piece. And I'm looking forward to see how it comes out from a different person rather than all being mixed by myself. So now it's opening up, and I'll really look forward to hearing Priest Keller's take on it, you know.
Oh, well, one of the things is, too, that the way that people record it, I mean, you can have someone who has a professional studio recording and someone who, you know, might just have the built-in microphone on their computer that they're recording. So you have a lot of work to do to make everything sound cohesive and fit together.
Although it has lent itself to some very interesting parts. The very, very first piece we did was a piece called Wall, inspired by the Berlin Wall. And a girl from America sent a part where she went out into a field and played a huge big set of bells, the carillon.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you play them small hammers and whatnot. And she recorded it on a basic, I don't really know what she recorded on, but it was something very basic. And the wind was howling and whatnot, but it added to the whole feel and mood to it. So
it gave kind of a storminess feel, which, you know,
absolutely
added itself to set being also associated with storms.
Absolutely.
Now, for some people, and I know one of them we'll talk about at the end, who unfortunately couldn't be here with us, they have trouble sometimes communicating what they're trying to say in a magical standpoint. So they'll use music as a way to convey what they're trying to say. How would you combine music and magical work? from both of you?
Well, there are a few primary ways that I combine the two. One that I alluded to earlier is the utilization of the creative act as a spur for self-transformation, reenacting the ultimate act of creation of the human psyche, or the possibility of the human psyche. And one way that I can do this is through using music as a form of keeping a magical diary. If the music that I create is an honest, real, effective representation of my state of being at the time, then by looking at the music that I create over time, I can track that change in being over time as well. In a way, it records the essential aspects of myself at the time, whether it's what music I'm listening to, what philosophical things I'm inspired by, what turmoil there is in my life that I'm trying to resolve through magical and non-magical means, etc. Another technique that I use often that was also alluded to here as well is setting the proper psychological cues for making other magic effective. The obvious one for that is the music that you use in the background in a ritual working. But there are other things as well. There are techniques for embedding your intent as represented by music in other media also, not just music as music, but music as part of a larger work. And also a bit of technology that I'll be talking about in a little more detail in a few minutes called audio sigils, essentially taking the technology of sigil magic as popularized by Fratere Udy, Peter Carroll, and so forth, drawing primarily on the work of Austin Osmond Spare, but others as well, translating that into the audio realm also. Another interest of mine where music and magic intersect is in the music of the spheres. This is related somewhat to my work within the Order of Khnum in the Temple of Set. The Order of Khnum is something of the philosophy department of the temple, attempting to take philosophy and recreate it in its original sense as itself an initiatory transformative discipline, and not just a study of knowledge of just what someone else said. It's actually forming your own philosophical ideas. But where the music of the spheres dovetails with that is because of its relation to the Pythagoreans and this revival in the Neoplatonic ideas in the early and late Middle Ages. And I'm very interested in where that sort of study and actual science coincide, which happens a lot, actually, particularly in the early Enlightenment era in European thought. One of the prime examples there is the work of Johannes Kepler, where by his conception of the music of the spheres, that is the cosmos as having a tuning that arises from the interrelation between the moving various moving parts of it, this actually provided him with certain insights that turned into, among other things, his three laws of planetary motion, which form the basis of modern astronomy. So what we have here is someone who has taken a medium built around the interrelations between data, which is essentially what music is. Music exists in terms of its interrelations with other notes that you're playing, whether it's harmony or chords or so forth. And so by doing this, he gains a greater insight into these data interrelations that provide real solutions to real problems. So when I'm looking at music as a magical technology, I'm very much interested in the real applications that come out of it, more than just the basic of setting the mood or something like that. Those can be important in my work, but I'm much more interested in what it can actually lead to that I can make real within the world of horrors as well.
Interesting. And Priest Elliot, if you could give your take on how you use music in your magical work.
Well, a lot can be derived from, can be seen from the music you listen to, from how you approach music, can be so storytelling, as in to the person you are and the person you're developing into. Going through the process of becoming a good musician, it is important to appreciate all styles of music, which we then can take into the greater world, where we realize that everyone is an individual, everyone is different. And we shouldn't set our own preconditions on how other people should be. And we do have that. We do set preconditions in music. We have a set this is how I think music should be,
mm-hmm.
outlook, and when in fact we should just appreciate it for what it is. They're individual pieces of art coming from people, and thank goodness they're not all the same, otherwise it would be a very dull musical world, and taking that philosophy out into the world is is something that I want to push from the black music element out into the wider temple and out into the greater world. And
that's actually something that's a good point, is you are taking some of the music of the black muse element and making it available to the public.
Our music is available on the usual channels like MySpace, but we also have a special place on edred.net, that's edred.net, which is Stephen Flowers, that's a Systems Flowers site, which is a brilliant, brilliant site, and we use it just as our own specific way of channel for people who want to purchase music of the Black Muse, and it's a non-profit little element, and we use the music to how we would put spread the black flame throughout the cosmos in many imaginative ways, and it helps us fund whatever we can for the element.
Yes, among other things, we should post the link for that as well as some of the other musical projects and technologies we're talking about here. Perhaps we can post those as on the webpage for this podcast rather than trying to read off the URLs.
Yeah.
Because that gets kind of kind of tedious.
Yeah, and actually I can post that within the show notes too, so anyone who downloads this through iTunes or whatever pod feeder, pod catcher they use, will be able to see those links as well. Now, Priest Keller, you were talking about audio sigils.
Yes.
Could you go into that a little more in depth? Because I know I've read some of Spare's work and the creation of sigils on paper, but tell me how you create audio sigils.
Sure. I'll share a little bit of what I recently presented in Ireland at the European Temple Gathering that took place a couple of months ago. And for those of you within the temple, this is also published within the Proceedings of the Euroclave, which was recently released by another adept from that area. The basic idea behind audio sigils, and I prefer to use the term audio sigils instead of musical sigils,
mm-hmm.
For reasons that I'll be touching on here, is as humans we're used to matching sounds to their physical sources. This was essentially the only way you could hear music until the invention of speakers and recording devices. You simply could not experience a sound that you did not personally witness, or at least were in close enough proximity to in order to experience its effects.
Right.
So audio sigilization is somewhat of an extension of this. The basic behind the work is to divorce sounds from their origin in order to obscure their source, but not to completely eliminate it. This is a distilling down of the sound to its essentials, while it's still somewhat recognizable subconsciously. Now, the point behind audio sigils versus musical sigils is not to make music. Just like with traditional sigils, they don't derive their power from their artistic achievement. The audio sigils don't derive their power from their musical nature either. Now, of course, they can turn into music in various clever ways. For example, in my Solstice Variations works, and other work that's been done by those within the temple. But generally, you don't have to be able to hum to it in order for it to be effective as a sigil.
Mm-hmm.
So similarly to the way one would cross out the repeated letters in a sentence, different computerized tools, such as Audacity with different plugins, a tool called Spear, etc., can be used to extract out portions of the sound as audio, as from its component audio wave, so that the essence of what was going on with the sound is still there, but it's no more recognizable as its original sound. Of course, techniques such as speeding up, slowing down, pitch transposition, various things can also be done to it as well to further obscure what's really being stated as the intent behind the recorded sound. And this can be used to distill it down to a succinct representation of the intent, similar to what a sigil would be in the end, a visual sigil in the traditional sense. As far as techniques for banishing these, once they've been implanted in the subconscious, the two techniques that seem to work best in my experience are to employ extreme volume with headphones. Mm-hmm. If you listen to it at ear-splitting volume, you are, among other things, you're causing various psychological changes in awareness as part of that. Because of the way that different sounds and pitches cause specific sections of neurons in the brain to fire, you are, by overloading them with information in this fashion, you were getting as many of them to fire as possible as once, thereby kind of implanting this into your subconscious in as many different ways as possible. Another way, which again has an analog with the traditional banishing methods with sigils, is to subsume it into the background. Basically, have it be part of the background music that you hear as you go about your everyday life, much as you might put a sigil on the wall next to your computer monitor that you sit by every day, so that eventually you no longer notice it, but it is still there and is still causing an effect. Putting audio in this way can also put it into the background of your awareness as you go about your everyday life, which is an effective way of enticing your subconscious mind to work on the problem at hand more effectively without the lust of result brought in from the conscious mind.
Right. And I know there are people that have worked with like binaural beats that at various frequencies can enhance the theta waves of your brain or the alpha waves of your brain. And
yes.
So essentially that sounds kind of like what you're trying to do.
Yeah, there are definitely some parallels there. One key difference is with audio sigils, there is something very specific that you're trying to implant through this method. It's not... with binaural beats, there's not a specific purpose behind the binaural beat, necessarily. You're essentially trying to get your brain going at a certain wavelength, which forms the basis for perhaps importing other ideas into it. Whereas the musical sigil would be, in that terminology, would be the idea itself. Binaural beats actually is a technique that I've used as part of the sigils, basically creating an audio file that contains both the binaural beat and the musical sigil itself, putting it on repeat, listening to it for a long enough time that the binaural beats begin to have their effect, and at that point you have created a more receptive state that you can import the audio sigil itself with. So that's sort of a combining of those two ideas. So I would say that they kind of dovetail, but they have slightly different purposes in the overall technology.
Right. They can be used together, but they aren't the same thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Now, the Book of Coming Forth by Night, which is the document that was originally written during a ritual that Dr. Aquino did when he founded the Temple of Set, was used by you to... you were inspired by that to write some music to that. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I originally did a piece derived from the Book of Coming Forth by Night in 2002, which was the 27th year since the reception of that book by Dr. Aquino. The 27th year was not an accident. This plays into the idea of Anton LaVey of what he called the working year, the cycles of 9 years. Essentially, every 18 years, which is the length of a working year, a cycle comes to its completion. At the apex of that, 9 years in the middle, the cycle is at its greatest creativity and its greatest effect. So these are for magic that you wish to work in the long term. Those periods are ones that can be taken advantage of in order to maximize that effect. So since the this 27 years would have been the peak of the second working year since the founding of the Temple of Set, which corresponds to the reception of the Book of Coming Forth by Night. This seemed to be an advantageous time to embark on something like this. The basic idea behind what I called the musical sigil of the Book of Coming Forth by Night was to take the text of the book itself and apply various rules to the text to map the letters and words onto musical notes. The original technique I used for that was to essentially take wherever the letters A through G appeared in the text to play that corresponding note. And where a letter not A through G appeared, or punctuation, or any other mark, to increase the length of the previous note proportionally. So by using those two together, we essentially have notes and rhythm. And when you have notes and rhythm, you have music. So this provided a basis for constructing music out of the notes that still had the same ebb and flow as the original text itself, and embodied something of that ebb and flow in a different medium to give one a different way to experience the text. That original piece from 2002 was created as a very long form ambient piece. It's been used by many people within the temple, I hear, as part of rituals and even as background music for other things as well. This time last year, or maybe a couple years prior to that, or a couple of months prior to that, rather, I had the idea of revisiting that, given my growth as a musician and a magician over that time, and wanted to see what could be done to improve on that, and to tackle it from other means as well. So I did another version of the extended version with based on the same original technology, and then decided that there were other ideas that could be mined there as well, and created a work out of this that I called the Solstice Variations. The solstice is a reference to the North Solstice, aka the summer solstice on June 21st, which was the time of year that the Book of Coming Forth by Night was transcribed by Dardo Aquino, and also corresponded to the time in Egyptian mythology where Set was said to rule the skies. So along with that original piece, an updated version of that original piece, the Solstice Variations included a non-ambient, a much shorter version of the same idea, where some more advanced rules were used for creating the music. It was no longer as simple as just using the notes A through G. There were various techniques for adding some harmonic variation to it so that it was more interesting from a musical point of view. And that created a piece that's also available online at the edred.net site for the Saturnin Sector project. That link will also be in the podcast notes as well. As well links to all of the other music that I've referred to here. Other variations that were done along this theme, there was one that had no direct relation to the Book of Coming Forth by Night, but was merely inspired by it. There was another one that was comprised entirely of the voices of the members of the Victory Pylon of the Temple of Set, reading different sections from the Book of Coming Forth by Night. Their voices were transformed in various ways to make both musical and non-musical aspects of that particular piece, so that occasionally you can hear voices, occasionally you pick out a word or two, occasionally you hear something that you're not sure what it is. The overall effect of that, as it was intended, was to be something along the lines of an electronic voice phenomenon, which is perhaps a topic for another podcast, but the gist of that is the in recording various digital signals, different sounds can be heard, which either sound reminiscent to or sound like actual human voices, even in situations where there should have been no human voice present.
Right.
This is a real example of how one might create such a thing, that if someone were to listen to this without knowing the real story behind its creation, might interpret it in such a way. And then there was the fourth variation on the solstice there was created based off of the numerology that's implied within the book of Coming Forth by Night. What I mean by the numerology is there are several things about the structure of the book that that go in cycles and build on each other. Different rhythms, different years, and other numbers that are referenced. For example, 1904 was referenced a couple of times, 1975 was referenced a couple of times. Those have various relations to the Aeon of Horus and the Aeon of Set, respectively. 1966, the founding of the Church of Satan, and so forth. So basically by taking that and using those as the basis for either notes or rhythms of both, another piece was created that's not just inspired by the Book of Coming Forth by Night, but actually has a direct relation to it, and that reflects the structure of it, so that you could say that if Set wrote the Book of Coming Forth by Night as interpreted by Michael Aquino, this is essentially a translation of the different aspects of that into music, so that the music is essentially also written by Set, as it were.
Right. Yeah, like there's been people who've translated the Book of Coming Forth by Night from English into German, into Spanish, into Finnish, and you just basically translated it into music.
Yes. Yes, and as with any translation, a literal translation of anything, whether it's a magical text or not, is rarely sufficient. There has to be a certain amount of insight on the part of the translator in order to really capture the essence of the original in the new form that it's being given. That was my intent all along, to try to do essentially a musical interpretation of how I understand it. So it contains both the original book and it contains part of me as well, but the melding of the two into something that transcends myself only because of the origin of the source material.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Now, there's someone that I really wish we could have gotten on the show today, but he wasn't available. But he has written some inspired works as well. And that's Eric Kaushin, who started, I think it was somewhere around 15 years ago, with the Symphony of the Nine Angles, which he was trying to understand what the Nine Angles were. And it was a very foreign concept to him. And he actually conducted a working where he basically was in his studio and he started playing music. And each of the Nine Angles is represented by a musical piece. Now, granted, symphonies are supposed to have only four movements. There are a few cases where there have been three movements, but he didn't let it get in the way of his idea, and he came up with the Symphony of the Nine Angles. And then the next release he did was the Vampiric Suite, which was actually each of the pieces in that was inspired by one of the members of the Order of the Vampire. And then he decided to start getting a little experimental, and he released the Gothic Choir, which was inspired by H.P. Lovecraft. And that piece, actually, what's interesting is there's absolutely no instruments used in that. That was all his voice. And then he decided to take it another step further and released The True Sounds of Relia, which was recently released, and that is an hour-long piece that is essentially a sort of ambient background. It's kind of like Lustmord, only much thicker sounding, and I will put links to that. Because that's also, those are available through iTunes and through Amazon.com right now. Well, I think this has been a really interesting discussion that we've had, And I hope that our listeners will gain something from this. Now, something interesting happened last week is I actually received an email from a listener who is not a member of the Temple of Set, but had some questions, and I thought it would be kind of interesting to run this. Let me read the email, and we can all go through and answer the questions, because he has three questions here. He says, I've recently discovered your podcast, KHPR, and had a few questions for you about the Temple of Set. Would you be willing to address some of these in future podcasts? Okay, that's the first question, technically. So, yes, we will. His first question is, how rigorous is the entrance process for temple members? Should I plan on waiting hours, days, or weeks before my application is processed? Okay, well, I'll take this one since I used to be the assistant executive director. There are, if you go to kefer.org, and that's xeper.org, you can find our general information letter that tells you about the Temple of Set. It also has an application that we ask you to fill out. And, you know, rule number one is you have to be 18 or older. No exceptions to that, because we want you to be mature enough to understand the religion that you're getting involved with and to be able to initiatorily self-transform yourself. Then we're going to need your full name, your sex, your birth date, your address and phone number, and also a photocopy of your driver's license, identification card, passport, whatever, so we can associate it with who you are. There's also a check for $80, or you can include your credit card information for that. And the next step, after we receive it, our executive director, who processes these rather quickly, looks to see if there's a member of a priesthood that is living nearby to you. And if so, they will send you an email and arrange a meetup, and they will give their assessment back to the executive director as to what they think about you, as to whether or not you would fit with the Temple of Set. Oh, and one of the other things you have to send along with that is basically your background. Tell us a little bit about yourself, if you've been involved with any other magical organizations, things like that, just to give us an idea of who you are. We need something to work with. We don't let just anyone in the door. We want people here who want to bring about change to themselves. We don't want everyone in the world to be a Setian, because that would be utter chaos, actually, if that were to happen. So I hope that answers your first question. Now, the second question is, you mentioned in your last podcast that once accepted, you would have access to some sort of list of members. Can I keep my name off this list?
We do have a list of members in the Temple of Set, but it is an order. It is an organization where people interact with each other, and I can't actually understand why someone would want to keep their name off the list, because we interact with each other, we learn from each other, and when we get together, we have what's known as a quickening of minds. And why would you want to exclude your name off the list for a start? But yes, there is a list, and your name will be on the list, but it's nothing sinister. It is a name. It's a list of members. For example, if someone else in your area joins the Temple of Set, we can put you in contact with them, etc., or you can contact them. And it's an active organization. As Magister Adam says, it is for people who bring about change. And within the Temple of Set, you will meet some of the most amazing individuals you'll ever meet in your life. And by keeping your name off this dreaded list, which it isn't, you're denying yourself the opportunity to speak with some fantastic people who are expertise in various fields of magic, philosophy, and the arts, etc. It's all there for, you know, we are a school of learning, and, you know, be part of it.
Well, and one of the other things I should add is that, you know, your personal information like phone number and address are not included. That's only available to members of the priesthood and above.
Yeah.
Yes.
We have what we refer to as the Pool of Nehe, which is an online forum where people discuss various topics. And you can, you know, give out your email address there. Your name obviously will be there, and we do have some set rules. You know, we don't like people using pseudonyms there simply because of the fact that it's too hard to keep track of you. Is, you know, if you're recognized to the third degree and, you know, you're not Priest Andrew Keller, but, you know, Lord Zoth of Azeroth. You know, it's like, oh, which one is he now? Oh, okay. It makes it easier. And, you know, there's really no reason for you not to use your real name. And actually, the third question is probably part of the reason why he asked the second question. I'll be to the point here. I have a respectable position with a massive multinational company that I believe social association with the temple would probably hurt. What steps does the temple take to ensure my privacy is respected?
Well, that's actually a very good question, and that's been one that has vexed many people that have applied to the temple, I think. And this is not the first time that I've had that question asked. It's fairly simple. As Magister Adam said, there is an optional but highly recommended list by which you can share your willingness to talk with other Setians. That would only include access to you through the Pool of Nehe. You don't have to actually give out your real email address or real address or anything else as part of that, unless you choose to. The full information for all Setians, name, address, telephone number, that sort of thing, is available to all members of the priesthood of Set, who are required as part of their office of priest to protect that information. It's only ever shared through encrypted PDF files that only the priesthood have access to, have access to the key for, and if it's printed out, members of the priesthood are required to protect that information under lock and key at all times. We take the privacy of our members extremely seriously. During the 9 years that I've been in the temple now, I do not know of any leak of that sort of information that has occurred, because it is so sensitive, and we all have a vested interest in ensuring that the privacy of not only ourselves but the rest of our members is protected. The list of members and information is protected by the executive director through a database that he maintains that's accessible only to him and a couple of other members of the temple's executive body. Given that the temple is incorporated as a religious organization, as a 501c3 tax-exempt religious organization in terms of the laws of the United States, that we are effectively enjoying the same privilege that, for example, a Catholic priest would in terms of people associating with that priest. It's subject to the same privilege as that. Right. We do not intend to ever allow that information to be accessible outside of the temple for any reason. And we do go to great lengths to ensure that privacy is protected.
And one of the things, too, is while people who join as a first degree, we tend to have a bit of turnover rate. As you go up in degree, you have less and less people who leave the Temple of Set. So there's sometimes people think, you know, well, what if a member of the priesthood leaves and decides to share that information? So far, it hasn't happened. There was one case where that happened years ago, before, and this was like in the early 80s or something like that. And sometimes you find these lists online, but I mean, the funny part is they've they get updated every once in a while, and I'm sure Barack Obama's name will now show up as being a member of the Temple of Set. Last year, for the last few years, George Bush and his father were listed as members of the Temple of Set, and they have Bill Gates and Steve Jobs as members, like we're some secret Illuminati or something like that.
And the entire Rothschild family?
Yes. it's which is one of the humorous things when we see this come out, especially considering that with very few exceptions, everyone on that list who actually was in the temple is no longer in the temple. So that's really not something that you have to worry about. We're much more able to protect our information of our members now. Our executive director actually uses only a secure form to transmit the password to access the members list, and that's usually by telephone. So you'd have to have his phone tapped, as so many of us like to use Skype, and Skype is fully encrypted, and no one has yet been able to break that, he can also transfer it to you through Skype. So, you're very safe at this point. Well, I think, as I had mentioned earlier, I would like to share some of the Black Muse Element music, and I would like to thank you, Priest Keller and Priest Elliot, for being on the show.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much for inviting us to partake in this.
And now the piece is called The Blood is the Life. And this was written for The Order of the Vampire. And I think when you listen to it, you will really get the feeling of the vampiric essence, basically. So thank you for listening to the show. And we will be back again soon. You've been listening to KHBR, The Voice of Darkness. If you have any questions or comments, you can email them to us at khpr@keffer.org. Thank you for listening, and we hope that we've been able to bring about some change for you.